This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Hey, y'all. I just want to remind y'all because it's been a little bit over 3 weeks, okay? It's been a little bit over 3 weeks.
We begin with Cardi B.
Trump is now ordering federal government workers to go back to work without getting paid.
The rapper's Instagram video has over 11 million views and counting.
This is crazy. Like, our country is in a hellhole right now.
Stephen Colbert weighed in, too.
We have now hit day 26 of the government shutdown, and vital services are being threatened. For instance, I've run out of shutdown jokes. We might have to dip into the National Reserve at this point.
If only we had more reserves of maturity to dip into. The fight over the border wall deteriorated further as missives flew between Capitol Hill and the White House.
President Trump denying a military jet for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who was reportedly set to head out of the country for a meeting with foreign allies. This after Speaker Pelosi called to postpone the State of the Union address. All of this.
But the State of the Union seems years away. Meanwhile, thousands of unpaid federal workers continue inspecting our food, securing our air travel, and sending tax refunds. Many are relying on the compassion of landlords, local restaurants, and even their workplaces for food. In past shutdowns, the press focused on the inconvenience to tourists.
At Great Falls in Virginia, the closed sign turns visitors away at the front gate. In West Virginia, the Harpers Ferry National Historic Park is closed to history bus.
But the longest shutdown in history is different. Now we're hearing about all kinds of hurt from Alabama.
There are several Alabama programs that could be affected if the federal government does not fully reopen. For instance, the WIC program provides nutritional help for women, infants, and children.
To Nevada.
If the Valley loses public housing funding, we could face a huge problem.
To Connecticut.
New at noon, FAA and TSA workers at Bradley International Airport have gone 4 weeks without a paycheck.
Thanks to robust reporting both inside Washington and coast to coast, we've been schooled in just what the government does and what happens when it doesn't.
Homeless shelters, they get money from HUD, domestic violence shelters, sexual assault programs.
Services the federal government is obligated to pay to Native Americans under treaty rights.
When our government starts to buckle, for real, the importance of local reporting can no longer be ignored or denied. But that vital sector of our republic has been undergoing its own agonizing sort of shutdown for decades.
This week, many of those reporters learned of a new familiar threat to their own futures. The Wall Street Journal reported on Monday that Gannett, the local news chain that owns USA Today and about 300 other papers, is the target of a hostile bid from the hedge fund Alden Global Capital. The deal isn't done, and no one knows exactly what this might mean for papers like the Arizona Republic or the Appleton Post-Crescent. We can't say what Alden will do. But we do know what it's done. So does Dave Krieger. For a time, he was the editorial page director of the Alden-owned Boulder, Colorado Daily Camera, until he wrote a post critical of his corporate overlords and was fired.
The tactic that Alden uses, and it does it through its newspaper front, which is called Digital First Media, they come in once a year, and they basically tell the executives of the paper what their take is going to be. It's a little like a mob protection racket. They come in and say, we're taking 20% of your revenues off the top. Good luck. Have a nice day. It is then up to the executives at the paper to keep the lights on. And the only way to do that with revenues declining year over year at pretty much every newspaper in the country is to cut news resources. Originally, the Daily Camera eliminated all its clerical positions, for example. So you have editors and reporters doing all the clerical work that needs to be done. It sold off the downtown office building that the camera worked in and kept moving the staff to smaller and smaller office space. And eventually, there's nothing left to do but to cut reporters. Boulder's a very dynamic community. It's a university town. It's 100,000 people. There's a Google campus. There's a Twitter campus. There's all kinds of stuff going on, and we just had no ability to cover any of it.
So let's just say that Alden is not known for its commitment to local journalism. And now it's after the 300-some Gannett papers. I am old enough to remember when Gannett wasn't the victimized damsel tied to the tracks. It was Snidely Whiplash doing the victimizing. When I worked at the Wilmington News Journal, a Gannett paper in the early 80s, the company had the reputation of slashing costs of the papers it had acquired. And I believe you were a former Gannettoid yourself, aren't you?
Twice over, yeah. Gannett for many years was known and is today known as the McDonald's of journalism. They were the consolidator. They were all about profitability. Gannett was the bottom of the barrel. It was the worst you could do as a reporter for many years.
Comparing the historical Gannett of consolidation and cost-cutting and everything that goes with it, was anything that chain did even remotely comparable to what Alden has done in the properties that it owns?
It was not as bad, but it was comparable in the sense that Gannett sort of pioneered this concept that you could consolidate all kinds of functions that used to be the province of the individual newspaper. You didn't have necessarily a copy desk anymore at your newspaper because there was some central location where copy editing took place. You didn't necessarily have page designers at your newspaper because there was some central location where that took place. The delocalization of news in order to save money, that was a Gannett process. The difference is Gannett began as a newspaper company 100 years ago, and it's still a newspaper company. Its interest is in keeping those newspapers alive. Alden does not care whether the papers survive. As you may know, Ken Doctor, the newspaper analyst, suggests that on the current trajectory, a lot of Alden properties will be dead in the water within 3 or 4 years from now. And as I say, I think that's fine with Alden because they will just take the cash and move on to the next distressed asset.
All right. So there may not be a better example of sort of predatory capitalism than what we're discussing now. On the other hand, no laws are being broken. And Gannett is in the position of trying to protect the fiduciary interests of its shareholders and the offer that Alden is making is significantly higher than what Gannett shares are trading for. It will be hard for them to turn this down. You know, what does that suggest? And I guess I wonder if you think there's anything that can be done about this.
I don't want to get too sanctimonious about this, but there's the famous Thomas Jefferson quote about whether if he had a choice between a government and no newspapers and newspapers and no government, he'd choose the latter. That seemed to make no sense to a lot of people, but the point he was making was self-government is impossible without an informed citizenry. And in fact, that's been the criticism of democracy over time. Most skeptics of democracy persisting for long periods of time are skeptical because they think the citizenry ultimately will be so ill-informed that it is not capable of governing itself. Plato made that argument 2,500 years ago in the Republic. If capitalism is allowed to destroy local journalism in this way, that's where we're headed. And as you say, distressed asset investing has a long tradition. It is part of capitalism. Ben Graham called it cigar butt investing 100 years ago. He's Warren Buffett's mentor. So it's definitely legal and it's part of capitalism. But we have never been at the point where it was about to destroy an institution that is protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution. Is there a way to protect what our founders thought was so important from an economic system that now seems bent on destroying it?
What's going on with you?
I appear to be retired.
I'm sorry to laugh, but it doesn't sound as though that was your plan. It sounds like the situation in which you've unfortunately found yourself.
Going out into the job market as a 60-something veteran of 40 years in what is perceived to be a dying industry, the newspaper industry, you know, there's not a lot of interest out there in the market. That's where we are.
Okay, Dave. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
You bet.
Dave Krieger is the former editorial page editor of the Boulder Daily Camera.
Coming up, if you think we have gridlock, may we call your attention to Brexit?
This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
The eyes to the right, 202. The nose to the left, 432.
While we trudge through the slog of a government shutdown, Great Britain and the European Union are in the midst of a slow-motion train wreck.
Stunning loss for British Prime Minister Theresa May as the Parliament strikes down her Brexit plans.
Theresa May has just won a no-confidence vote in Parliament.
She says that could mean the end of the increasingly controversial divorce.
The UK will split from the EU on March 29th, and there's still no plan for how. No plan for borders, no plan for trade, no plan for taxation, because the public said no to Europe and Parliament said absolutely not to Theresa May's plan for the exit. And as though living through the uncertainty wasn't enough, this month Brits got to watch a TV movie, Brexit, re-examining the 2016 referendum.
In a different branch of history, I was never here. Some of you voted differently, and this never happened. But I was. And it did.
Benedict Cumberbatch plays Dominic Cummings, the strategist behind the Vote Leave campaign. Cummings used Facebook data from such dodgy purveyors as Cambridge Analytica to target voters, and it was he who came up with the campaign's cunningly effective slogan, Take Back Control.
Everyone knows who won, but not everyone knows how.
In Britain, the conversation around the film, even before it aired there on Channel 4 earlier this month, was how soon is too soon to explore a story that's still unfolding, and how much fiction is permissible and healthy about history still in the making. For instance, the real Cummings refused last summer to appear before Parliament. He's shown in the film, apparently years in the future, testifying. Will Brits think that he has been held accountable? Brexit is set to air on HBO stateside for the first time on Saturday, January 19th. Playwright James Graham is the screenwriter. He decided that instead of focusing on well-known Brexit figures like Theresa May or Boris Johnson, the film would follow Cummings and the director of the Remain campaign, Craig Oliver.
The bizarre aspect of a referendum campaign is that in front of the camera are all these familiar figures. They go out to sell these ideas and these policies. But in actual fact, they aren't the decision makers. The decision makers are the strategists who are completely unknown, completely unelected, and completely unaccountable, who come up with the policy visions and the ideas and the messaging.
We'll appeal to their hearts, emotional resonance, their hopes, their dreams, their aspirations, their fears, suspicions.
These figures are completely unknown, so it felt right to me to put those center stage.
Cumberbatch brings the same hyper-intense, manic, I don't even know the words, almost hallucinatory quality that he brought to the Sherlock series.
Britain makes a noise, an actual noise. Did you know that? It groans. It's been groaning for some time.
And he's using all this Cambridge Analytica data and other lethal tools of guerrilla war. Was he really the evil genius architect of Brexit? Or is this a bit of artistic exaggeration?
There are two camps. There are the camps who thinks he's a genius. He felt the mood of a nation and identified long before Brexit, and in fact long before Donald Trump, this populist anti-establishment anger and mood sweeping across the Western world, and knew how to tap into that to get the results that he wanted. There's then another view, which is that he's an absolute fraud. He's a pseudo-intellectual who has just learned lots of quotes from Greek philosophy and Russian history, but it's all meaningless and empty, and he just got lucky. The fact is, I don't know. I was very lucky, actually, to spend time with Dominic. He's not really given any interviews since the referendum campaign. He hasn't yet appeared before Parliament, even though Parliament has requested his attendance. He didn't want to meet a journalist for some reason. He wanted to meet a playwright. So some of the ideas and the arguments that the Benedict character posits in this movie are the first time that an audience would have heard those. But I don't think the film comes down either side. I think you, the audience, should decide whether or not he's gifted or he's a fraud.
You mentioned Cumming's refusal to testify before Parliament. The film opens with Cumming's testifying before Parliament. I gather this is imagined at some time in the future.
Its primary purpose is to investigate the use of our personal data in political campaigns and the way in which it is rapidly altering democracy.
What's going on there?
I don't mind admitting that some people have disagreed with us on this, because there's a danger that you are implying that he has testified and actually he resolutely hasn't done that, and it's important not to get that wrong. You'll notice at the beginning of the film, there is a character called Elizabeth Denham who's questioning him, and she's the information commissioner. And she references the fact that the referendum was 4 years ago.
This inquiry was established by the information commissioner's office following revelations concerning the European referendum 4 years ago in 2016.
And that's our subtle way, I suppose, of signposting that this is set possibly around 2020, 2021. Drama can hold these people to account and ask them questions and also put their arguments before the public in a way that yet hasn't been satisfied.
Carol Cadwalader, who is an investigative reporter for The Guardian and has been reporting on Cambridge Analytica's role in the Brexit campaign, she says that the movie, quote, whitewashes the deeply serious criminal offenses we know were committed. And she accuses HBO of, quote, literally interfering with the criminal justice system. How plead you on that?
To be honest, everybody has their own version of what they think the Brexit film should be. Some people think I focus too much on Cambridge Analytica and the data. Some people, including Carol, know when they're enough. I retweeted all of Carol's objections to the film because I want to create a debate. We don't mislead. We absolutely reference the criminality that was accused, acknowledge that they were found guilty of overspending and that Facebook were charged a record fine for the misuse of data. These things are there. But for me, it was important to not get necessarily hung up on things that, one, would either completely isolate a Leave voting audience, and two, the point wasn't to operate a checklist of accusations towards a particular side of the referendum. I was more interested in the universal themes of what did that referendum say about us? Who are we now? Can truth exist in a world of lies? Can we ever be objective about our politics and evidence-based truths ever again? And that might sound very playwrighty, but I had to aim for something slightly more poetic and larger than some of those very specifics.
Do you believe that it was Cummings or whoever had been running the operation would have achieved approximately the same result?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I'm aware that throughout history, playwrights in particular have romanticized the potential influence of the individual, because that's what makes good drama, that a single person can change the course of a nation's destiny. If you want my personal view, I think that of course individual people can make a difference, and of course campaigns can make a difference. Otherwise, why else do we have election? But I do believe that Dominic Cummings as an individual did possibly increase enough voter turnout to affect what was a very narrow win for that campaign, particularly through the phrase that they discovered, the slogan for the Leave campaign, which was take back control.
To take something back means it was, is rightfully yours, taken from you. So much of our understanding of who we are comes from this nostalgic view we have of our past.
It may be your job, maybe your money, maybe yourself, a sense of national identity. Everybody could pour into that empty box of a slogan, the anger that they had, and they just created a whole constituency that nobody knew existed.
There is an extraordinary scene. It's a focus group staged by the Remain camp, but is composed of people who are likely leavers and remainers, who wind up screaming at one another, making accusations of racism and more.
The past few years have been awful!
That's right, so let's make
it. If you must know!
That will solve
and
trouble.
All I hear all the time is shut up! Don't talk about it. Don't mention it. Ever. Well, I'm sick of it! I'm sick of feeling like nothing! Like I have nothing! Like I know nothing! Like I am nothing! I'm sick of it!
We forget now, because the campaign was so dramatic, a member of parliament is assassinated by somebody who screamed, "Put Britain first, put Britain first." So something was unleashed by the asking of this question, and it was a devastating failure of our nation, from politicians to normal people, to be able to answer it in a reasonable and considered way.
As the UK tries to figure out what to do next, will your movie be at risk of being too reductive or too influential at a very, very sensitive time?
So if we can accept that it's journalism's right to, on a daily basis, make suggestions and ask questions and posit theories, why shouldn't art and why shouldn't drama? I think drama has a duty to declare itself as fiction, and I think our film does that in quite a heightened tone and quite a heightened aesthetic. It's quite theatrical. So you know that it's not a journalistic document. It's a character study of what motivated these people. The second point is, we're not claiming this is the definitive version of this story. I'm hoping that there'll be many, many more plays and films that come out over the next decade that continually add and contribute to this conversation.
James, many thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you.
James Graham is the screenwriter of Brexit. The film airs on HBO at 9 Eastern on Saturday, January 19th. In the movie, Cummings bemoans the lack of critical analysis about the state of British society and beyond.
A million important questions to be asked of our nation, our species, our planet. And no one's asking the right ones.
British national identity, or more specifically English national identity, was always defined by the fact that we are an island nation.
Matthew Goodwin is a professor of politics and international relations at the University of Kent and author of National Populism, The Revolt Against Liberal Democracy. He says the right questions were actually staring us in the face all along.
Britain's entire post-war relationship with the EU was defined by Britain being the awkward partner. It had opt-outs of key things such as the euro single currency.
Euroscepticism, you might say, is in its DNA.
We were never really fully committed to the European project in the way that the French or the Germans or the Italians were.
Goodwin explains that from 1995 to 2016, there was actually consistent and widespread public support for dramatically rethinking Britain's relationship with the EU.
And groupthink really led us to the opposite conclusion, that Remain was always the clear favourite.
If Brexit was a backlash, you say, it wasn't a backlash to immigration per se, but to a larger issue, the perceived overreach by liberal democracy in the form of the European Union, and a perceived loss of sovereignty and national identity, all of which sentiments were hiding in plain view. The Leave vote didn't magically materialize from nowhere, and it wasn't just a bunch of racist ruffians.
Well, I think one of the ignored elements of the Brexit debate is the diversity that existed within the Leave electorate. And if you look at actually who ended up voting Leave, there was basically an alliance of pretty affluent middle-class conservatives who were predominantly wanting a restoration of national sovereignty.
The European Union, in its manifestations, can impose laws on us which we do not want, can refuse to repeal laws which we think have outlived their usefulness.
There were white working class, traditionally left-wing Labour voters who were more anxious about what they saw as the sort of high levels of migration and rapid change at the local level.
There's lots of Muslims, lots of people around here which are taking our jobs.
One in three of Britain's black and minority ethnic voters opted for leave, and recent research suggests that they were unhappy with the way in which our migration policy gave preference to people from within Europe at the expense of some of their networks and relatives outside of Europe.
The UK need to be a separate country. People like myself paying tax. If somebody else in Europe, they don't working and eating my money, why?
And also, there was a large degree of support for leave among Britain's pensioners who came of age in a very different period when Britain was a global superpower and when it wasn't so closely aligned to the European Union. Leavers wanted to talk about identity and sovereignty and community, and Remain were just talking to them about GDP, the national economy, and financial costs and benefits.
The prevailing media narrative is that 17 million gullible and resentful voters who don't understand markets or governance or economics or law were tricked into consigning the UK into isolation and irrelevance. But you say that such blind adherence to the march of liberal democracy does a disservice to legitimate grievances.
Where Leave were particularly effective was picking up on that sense among voters that they are no longer really being recognized or being given a voice in the political system. And Fukuyama famously argued in his book, The End of History, that liberal democracy really did one of two things. Aside from offering the capitalist system and developing a very effective economic model, it actually also satisfied people's struggle for recognition. It gave them a sense of voice. I think what many leavers felt, particularly by the time that we got to 2016, was that actually nobody in the political system was listening to them. And certainly in our book, we make the point that one in two working class voters in Britain had concluded that actually they weren't being listened to in Britain's political system, and they certainly weren't being listened to in the European Union's political system. And I think partly, therefore, the vote to leave the EU became something much more powerful, which was an attempt by voters to get their views, to get their values back onto the political radar.
Now, the occasion for your article is your own personal astonishment that amid the current post-Brexit chaos, to this day, few in the media or government or the academy have truly reflected at how it got into this mess. They see it, you write, as a spasm of naked, ignorant, and malign populism, not as really a historical inevitability. Your piece was a bit of screed against that kind of self-validation and arrogance.
Many people, not only in the academy, but also large parts of Britain's media, struggled to make sense of the vote to leave and where it had come from. Our media is still incredibly London-centric. Many people who are reporting on the mood in the nation have gone through Oxford or Cambridge and often private schools. And I think the shock that met the leave vote was partly a reflection of that, that we just simply don't have a media debate, we don't have a national debate that's truly representative of the country. And that perhaps also explains why so many people expected Remain to win.
We're having this conversation in the midst of chaos. Parliament has just not just voted down, but crushed Prime Minister May's Brexit plan. And 2 months from B-Day, there's no mechanism for any kind of soft landing into whatever the new reality is. All the indications are instead for a catastrophic crash. There is talk of a referendum to reverse the first referendum, but you believe that would surely be catastrophic. Why?
Pragmatically, I can understand how we end up having a second referendum because there is no majority in the House of Commons for a Brexit deal. Mrs. May has lost her deal. She was defeated heavily, and her opponents do not have a majority for an alternative route. There are many problems with that, however. The first is we have no idea what we'll put on the ballot paper. Would it be Mrs. May's deal versus a no deal? Would it be Mrs. May's deal versus remaining in the European Union? Would it be Mrs. May's deal versus some other option? And the reason that's problematic is when you survey voters, they don't really know even now what's in Mrs. May's deal. So this is a very low information environment, and referendums are supposed to be really only introduced when there's a very clear binary question. Are you in? Are you out? But secondly, I think it's problematic because it's going to send a pretty troubling message. We have to remember what happened before the first referendum. A lot of blue-collar workers in industrial towns had simply stopped voting, and they'd been giving up on politics. They'd concluded that when it came to these big issues like Britain's relationship with Europe, like immigration, like their role and their voice within the political system, that it wasn't worth voting. My worry when it comes to the prospect of a second referendum is actually we send those voters quite a worrying message, which is that actually, even though you came out and voted Leave and you tried to reclaim that sense of voice, you made the wrong decision and you're going to have to vote all over again. By asking those voters to vote again, effectively until they give the right answer, are we not just pouring gasoline on the sense among many voters that backlashing is actually the only way to get things done?
Matt, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed listening to your show from London.
Matthew Goodwin is a professor of politics and international relations at the University of Kent and co-author of National Populism, The Revolt Against Liberal Democracy.
Once we ruled over an empire, so it feels like some kind of defeat to comply with rules drawn up by strangers and measure in meters, not feet.
Coming up, another global culture war is afoot on YouTube.
This is On the Media.
If we can't be in charge, then we must.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So, we've got a battle over Brexit, which fundamentally is about big symbolic issues: power, sovereignty, inclusion. And we're up against a wall over the U.S. government shutdown, which also is about big symbolic issues like executive power, national priorities, and the role of government. And then there's the hand-to-hand combat taking place under our very noses over who is the supreme leader of YouTube. 160 million people have taken sides in what is depicted as a David versus Goliath story, or maybe Goliath versus Goliath. Let's start with...
How's it going, everyone? My name is PewDiePie.
So PewDiePie is a character played by Felix Schellberg. He is a caustic and funny gamer.
Clay Shirky is a tech writer and vice provost of educational technology at New York University. He's tracked PewDiePie's 9-year rise to the top of YouTube.
He's Swedish. He lives in England. He's 29. And he's one of the first generation of YouTubers who did it as a hobby and converted it to a career.
PewDiePie's subscriber count started to rise on the appeal of a now classic genre of videos called Let's Play, as in, you watch him goof around while he plays a game. He's now got 80 million subscribers. But 2 years ago, he started dipping into controversy.
All right, Disney cutting ties with, what is this?
PewDiePie.
PewDiePie. The Wall Street Journal reporting that PewDiePie, the world's highest-paid YouTube star, posted 9 videos featuring anti-Semitic comments or Nazi imagery.
The Wall Street Journal reported that a January 11th video showed two men holding a sign that said "Death to all Jews," allegedly hired by the 27-year-old internet personality.
Google cut PewDiePie from its lucrative preferred ad program and canceled his premium YouTube original series. PewDiePie, by the way, did not respond to any of our requests for comment.
I'm sorry for the words that I used, as I know they offended people. I do strongly believe that you can joke about anything. Here's the thing, though. the media takes what I say out of context to portray me as a Nazi. Old school media does not like internet personalities because they're scared of us.
The context question is often used as a get out of jail card to say to people, I don't want to be held to standards other than those held by my own audience.
And I buy that. I do. But there's this really smart anthropologist, Crystal Abedin, and she went through a lot of the citations of PewDiePie's transgressions that were assembled by the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal circulated a still of PewDiePie supposedly making the Nazi salute, when this was actually him just extending his arm and pointing off screen. There was another one that the Wall Street Journal did of PewDiePie donning a uniform and watching Hitler videos, when this was actually the second half of a longer snippet in which PewDiePie first refuted earlier media accusations that he was a Nazi and then jokingly donning a British uniform while pretending to watch clips of Hitler's speech to depict how he thinks the media views him. I mean, this isn't just casual context.
No, that's right. But I don't think there's any claim of being out of context that saves the death to all Jews stunt.
Actually, I watched that entire thing. And he was asking a whole bunch of people to do things that he knew they wouldn't do. And this was one that he had put in that group on Fiverr, who for a certain amount of money will do something on video that you request. He'd asked for outrageous things. No one did it. And for $5, two guys from India did this death to all Jews thing. And you see his reaction.
I am sorry. I didn't think they would actually do it. I feel partially responsible, but just I didn't think they would actually.
And he looks genuinely shocked. He just never expected it. Now, should he have done that? Was it really obnoxious and creepy? Yeah, but I think he kind of conceded that himself.
Yeah, but that to me says he can sort of have it both ways.
There's a Wall Street Journal article that's out, written by the Daily Stormer's favorite group of guys, exposing plans to take over the world and make it white. Hitler is PewDiePie.
The problem with PewDiePie is not that he's a Nazi. The problem is that he's an asshole. And he wants to be both edgy and not upset people, because his audience expects edginess, but his advertisers expect not upsetting people. And one of his constant complaints about people pushing back on his edgy content, which often involves racial slurs or using the word retarded, casual homophobia, these kinds of things, is that he's being held to a standard that his own audience doesn't have, right? He's now finally being treated as a cultural figure who says something about the larger society. He's not just a gamer mouthing off to amuse other gamers.
PewDiePie's mounting controversies had little effect in his ranking as the most subscribed to YouTuber until the rise of the Indian super channel T-Series.
It's on course to become the most subscribed channel on YouTube and is about to pass the controversial personality PewDiePie.
Out of nowhere comes this channel, T-Series. They're at like 60 million subscribers, and their channel is going insane. And I'm thinking, who are these guys? What is T-Series?
T-Series is like India's Disney, almost synonymous with the films and music it produces, like the viral song Lahore by Guru Randhawa.
T-Series is, I guess, everywhere. Every part of the country, there is T-Series.
This is Indian YouTuber Carrie Manati, who has 5.5 million subscribers.
YouTube came in India very late. Before YouTube, we had CDs, DVDs, we had VHS, we had cassettes. Every Bollywood movie has a song in it.
Of course.
So most of them were released by T-Series. I think it's been there forever.
Forever, coming from a YouTuber who knows his way around the entertainment industry.
Okay, so I've been doing this for a long time. It's been like 10 years, I guess, now.
And how old are you?
I'm 19.
Wait a minute, you've been doing it since you were 9?
Yeah, kind of. I've been making like a lot of content, from like football tricks to PSP tutorials to gameplays, lot of things. I've done a lot of things.
Gulshan Kumar, son of a juice seller, started what became T-Series in 1983, growing it into what's now the ubiquitous emblem of Indian pop culture. And so it remains, though Kumar was murdered by the Mumbai underworld in 1997. Today, the company distributes Bollywood, Bhangra, and hip-hop in a variety of Indian languages, all of which is available on a YouTube channel, the subscribership of which has sometimes briefly even overtaken PewDiePie's.
We're failing! Another YouTube channel is taking over. That's right, in no less than in November this year. PewDiePie will not be the biggest channel on YouTube. No! We must fight back!
YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat were flooded with PewDiePie's calls to action.
I want to put subscribe to PewDiePie on the largest billboard in Times Square.
In this video, I will say PewDiePie 100,000 times to stop T-Series.
People around the world doing campaign for PewDiePie. And in Bangladesh, it's not different. People there sticking posters on the trees and the walls.
I am going to destroy my body with a subscribe to PewDiePie tattoo.
Everyone doing their part. Have you been doing your part?
They've taken control of printers around the world to create posters supporting the vlogger PewDiePie.
The other day, I was sitting at work, and the printer started printing something.
While 23-year-old Sarah Moore was working her job at a hair salon in Wilson, North Carolina, the office printer, one of 50,000 hacked worldwide, spat out posters promoting PewDiePie.
It was honestly one of the best things that's ever happened, because I never thought it would actually come to my salon that I work at and everything. Basically, I've always been a fan of PewDiePie, since, like, forever.
So what does the war represent to you?
The Wall Street Journal and, like, these other publications, basically, they're just taking things completely out of context. And to rise up and, like, defend him, I guess, and, like, have this battle for him, it kind of, to me, represents that YouTube still has this really, like, nice, deep-seated community of people who know what's right and what's wrong. And we live in a world where cancel culture is so strong. Somebody does one thing wrong, and then you want to cancel them forever.
Sarah disavows the anti-Semitic joke video, but believes his apologies are genuine, and her fear of cancel culture is shared widely on the platform. To many of his fans, PewDiePie is the David up against YouTube the Goliath, against the media Goliath, against the T-Series Goliath.
While everyone else is just moaning and complaining and turning our beloved T-Series into a tyrant, into this big music industry typhoon that's coming in and taking away the little guy, which, don't get me wrong, definitely is all those things. But it's our evil corporation, okay? For once, our evil corporation gets to win and gets to take the number one spot.
Canadian Indian YouTuber Jess Rain.
Because maybe it is our time now. Maybe your karma of colonizing us is finally catching up through us beating you and a completely unnecessarily racially motivated subscriber race on YouTube.
Meanwhile, the diss track Bitch Lasagna, with over 100 million views, is PewDiePie's most popular video. The song takes its title from a meme ridiculing the broken English of Indians online. Other YouTubers like Ethan Klein of H3H3 Productions have fanned the flames.
These mothers have like 1.4 billion people in India. They are churning out YouTube views in unprecedented numbers. Bollywood is the corniest on the history of the earth. And aren't all Indians the goofiest people you've ever met in your life? No, I'm kidding. That was a joke.
In response to PewDiePie, Ethan Klein, and the waves of anti-Indian hate on social media, Carrie Minotti made his own diss track in Hindi to capture how Indians are processing the feud.
I've seen a lot of comments that say that PewDiePie did it as a joke. And I've seen a lot of comments that say PewDiePie did not do this as a joke, and they are offended. Mm-hmm. And they are angry, and they're showing a bit of a rage. Desh ke khilaaf hui duniya. That means the world unites against our nation. Because a lot of people were saying that it's not just PewDiePie versus T-Series, it's India is like alone in this.
In an effort to defuse the vitriol unleashed by the subscriber war, PewDiePie asked his fans to support a charity for Indian children. Clay Shirky says the aggression exhibited by his most vocal fans suggests that for these guys, racism is the principal fuel.
He does offer lowercase w, lowercase s white supremacy.
What is that?
He is in that mode of white guy gamer for whom he exemplifies a kind of freedom to be caustic and insulting without consequence. And that is something that has been given to white men more than to other members of society. And to hear that people who like Bhangra and Bollywood music are going to displace him does, in fact, raise those cultural anxieties.
Do we want an American in the top YouTube spot, or do we want an Indian man succeeding better on a platform that us Americans created?
Former Gateway pundit, White House correspondent Lucian Wintrich at the right-wing American Priorities Conference in D.C. The neo-Nazi site Daily Stormer, with tongue firmly in cheek, called PewDiePie the true leader of all racists, anti-Semites, and fascists, hoping no doubt to entice a few of his terminally ironic viewers while inciting hysterics in the mainstream press. And PewDiePie's also gotten the nod from Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson, who depicts PC culture and left-wing politics as mortal threats to Western civilization.
Hey, Jordan, what are you doing right now?
I'm subscribing to PewDiePie.
What everyone has learned on all sides of the political spectrum now is how to take an isolated event in the world and add it to the giant referendum on everything that we're currently living through.
Even if PewDiePie doesn't mean it, especially if he doesn't mean it, because he's saying that if you don't mean it, it's kind of okay.
It's just a prank, bro. It's just a prank. Don't you like pranks, bro? I guess you don't like pranks.
Meanwhile, in the war for subscribers, the internet's Swedish emperor still claims the prize, but his grasp is increasingly shaky.
Smartphone penetration in India is less than 25%, which is to say the West has topped out. There will be incremental growth only. When India has triple the number of people online that it has now, something that's not possible in the US or Europe, T-Series will leave PewDiePie well behind. This is kind of John Henry and the Machine, right? There's this last-ditch attempt by PewDiePie's fans to kind of create fake demand to push him over the 80 million mark, which they've done, 80 million subscribers. Mm-hmm. But a lot of that's people's second email addresses or people doing it as a joke. Like, his view counts aren't going up as fast as his subscriber counts. Mm-hmm. This is not an audience anymore. Mm-hmm. But it's not even a competition because the T-Series people don't care.
We asked Louis, media analyst and the 11-year-old son of our executive producer, Katya Rogers, to offer some perspective from middle school. Louis says that subscribing to PewDiePie is more meme than anything else. In fact, he sees the current competition as merely a temporary reprieve for a brand that was already losing its luster.
Some people, I could see them listening to one sentence of PewDiePie and just hating him, thinking he's so racist, and he is a lot. Also, sometimes I could see him just doing it to get more views, just to get money. I don't feel like he's actually really trying for good content. So no one really watches his videos if they subscribe to PewDiePie. They just press subscribe, leave his channel.
But I still got paid anyway. But I still got paid anyway.
Right after this whole PewDiePie vs. T-Series thing, he's going to be gone. No one's going to care about him.
But I still got paid anyway.
I'm guessing that not many of you ever did care about him. But this show is about big symbolic issues, so I'll end on the ones addressed earlier this hour, the perils of capitalism and what happens when the basic human need for attention is denied, and wrap them both up in the saga of PewDiePie. This week, Eli Pariser wrote in Time magazine about restoring dignity to technology, and he drew on the work of Harvard researcher Donna Hicks, who tracked how violent conflict around the world arises from assault to human dignity, how being excluded stimulates the same part of the brain as a physical wound. Pariser laid out how online platforms like Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube threaten our dignity, ignoring what we want and distracting us with what we don't, so that we stay and stay and stay. Eager eyeballs, angry eyeballs, anguished eyeballs are all worth the same. PewDiePie knows this, and he may be sorry, but not that sorry. Extrapolate to the culture, it's not hard, and you'll see that it doesn't respect us either. I used to blame human nature for the messes we made online and off, but I'm starting to realize that our natures are plastic. We could be enticed easily to be our better selves, but we wouldn't be worth as much, because we wouldn't need to stay so long.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Oster Chaturvedi. We had more help from Zandra Ellen, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.